start by saying that with respect to the thermodynamic limit, especially as it shows up in statistical mechanical theorizing, statistical mechanics is distinctively interesting because it's sort of the paradigmatically inter-theoretic science. You know, we're often interested in trying to see how different sciences may be related, but statistical mechanics sort of takes on board the project of connecting the micro with the macro in a you know, very explicit fashion. So, for example, Menon and Callender, in a paper I'll be discussing or referring to several times in the course of the talk, say statistical mechanics is the theory that applies probability theory to the microscopic degrees of freedom of a system in order to explain its macroscopic behavior. And more generally, it aims to characterize and explain thermodynamic properties such as heat, free energy, and entropy of various macro aggregates, gases, liquids, and bulk matter as probabilistically determined by the micro properties of large numbers of micro entities, atoms, molecules, quantum entities, and sometimes a chemical species. And I want to talk a little bit about what statistical mechanics has to say about the thermodynamic macro features as just sort of getting ready to treat the role of the thermodynamic limit in statistical mechanics. So, for example, the SM approach allows for entropy to be theoretically derived and in this sense explained as a function of a probabilistic distribution of a large N system's microstates. And, of course, this was Boltzmann's groundbreaking contribution in identifying for certain kinds of thermodynamic system the entropy of that system with statistical entropy, where K is Boltzmann's constant. W is the number of microscopic arrangements or microstates that are associated with a given macrostate. So if you look at, for a given macrostate, you know, all the possible microstates that the system can be in, and that provides us sort of a probabilistic route to determining what the average expected value of that would be, and more in more or less complicated fashion to associate that with a given macro thermodynamic property. More generally, these features of different kinds of thermodynamic system are going to be understood in the SM theoretic terms as probabilistic functions of micro entities as they show up in different kinds of so-called ensembles. So nothing in what I'm going to say is going to turn on the details here, but there is a little bit of terminology that, you know, it's just kind of fun to learn and will be helpful in what follows. So, for example, you sometimes hear of the microcanonical ensemble. That's an ensemble that is supposed to, an ensemble of micro entities, it's supposed to describe an isolated thermodynamic system, one that's not exchanging energy or mass with its environment. And the canonical ensemble describes a non-isolated system in thermal equilibrium with its environment, one that is exchanging heat energy, but not mass. And then there's some other ensembles that one could characterize. For the canonical ensemble, for example, we'll characterize free energy. You can derive the probability that a system in thermal equilibrium at a certain temperature T will be in a microstate with a given energy. And since probabilities over the microstates that the macrostate the system can be in for a given temperature have to sum to one, you need a normalization factor, which is called the canonical partition function, in this case Z, which gives a measure of the number of microstates that the system can be at a given temperature. Now, the reason I'm talking about this is just to show you now very quickly some of the derivational relationships between the micro statistical functions and macro thermodynamic features. So with Z, you can use this to find the expected average value of any microscopic property of the system, which can then be related to the macroscopic thermodynamic variables. So, you know, more specifically in the canonical ensemble, we're going to identify the macroscopic internal energy U with the expected value of the microscopic energy E. So all that you really need to know is that, you know, this is a macroscopic feature in classical thermodynamics, which gets identified with some function of micro, probabilistic micro function. Then we can get that entropy S, again, a macro feature in terms of a function that, again, pertains to probabilistic features of the micro entities in the ensemble. And then we can get things like a free energy. And once you've got your internal energy, entropy, and free energy on the team, you can get other feature, macro features given other details. So, for example, pressure will end up being the derivative of U with respect to volume. So, again, nothing hinges on you somehow remembering those details. That's just one way to go. I just want to show you how it is, broadly speaking, how thermodynamic macro features are supposed to be understood in SM theoretic terms. Now, since we have these sort of descriptions, SM theoretic descriptions and associated explanations of thermodynamic properties, it's been very frequent to see this sort of relationship as paradigmatic of reductions of one type or another of the macroscopic to microscopic properties as per, you know, the old saw. Temperature is mean molecular kinetic energy. And more generally, it has been suggested that thermodynamics is paradigmatic of a special science treating broadly higher-level entities that's been reduced to more fundamental science treating more broadly lower-level entities. So classical thermodynamics supposedly reduced to statistical mechanics. Now, one thing we want to get clear about, which Peter also sort of adverted to in his talk, well, what notions of reduction are we talking about here? When some entity is reduced to another entity or entities, the former is supposed to be as a first very schematic pass, nothing over and above. The latter, but that said, different senses of reducibility might be at issue. One is broadly theoretical or representational, so relations between statements in various theories connected in the right kind of way. Second would be explanatory or epistemological, again, explaining these goings-on in terms of those goings-on. Or thirdly, ontological, metaphysical, according to which these goings-on are metaphysically nothing over and above, in some strong sense, those goings-on. Now, as the second pass specifically related, oh, I guess I could use this printer. Perhaps you do. Whew. As the second pass, specifically with respect to this third notion of reduction, the notion of this notion is more specifically understood as involving one or other identity claim. Now, the identity claim can get to be highly complex and sophisticated. It may be of either type or token variety. And to say that some entity is metaphysically reducible to some other entities is, as I understand it, and I think it's useful to understand it this way, is to say that the former is identical with, you know, either the other entities or some group of the other entities or some disjunction or other Boolean combination of those entities, or maybe it's a mereological sum of those entities. But the general idea is that ontological reduction involves identity of some goings-on with some ontologically lightweight combination of the lower level or other goings-on. So, for example, reductive physicalists might suppose, you know, they might have tried to say, oh, every mental state is identical with a type of physical state. But people say, oh, no, that won't work because mental states are multiply realizable. And they say, oh, yeah, what I meant to say is that every mental state is identical with a disjunction of physical states where each physical state type can realize the mental state type at issue. Okay, so the reductionist has, you know, some resources that they're just quite a lot of resources at their disposal. Okay, now going back to thermodynamics, has it been triply reduced? So you might think, well, all three types of reductions have been commonly supposed to hold in the case of thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, and the way you might come to think that is as follows. Well, in the first instance, the equivalences seem to be cases of theoretical or representational reduction, which allows certain macro properties appearing in classical thermodynamics to be derived from or described in terms of certain micro properties of the sort that are treated by statistical microphysics. In the second instance, though, these derivations are plausibly taken to provide explanatory grounds for the macro properties. So given antecedent commitment to the lower level physical goings on, the idea being that if we can in fact identify or describe these macro phenomena in microphysical terms, then that sort of provides a, you know, bottom-up explanation of why, for the existence and features of the macro systems that are at issue. So the derivational reduction seems to support an explanatory reduction. And then in the third instance, the explanatory and representational reductions seem to provide support for supposing that the thermodynamic macro properties are moreover metaphysically reduced to the statistical mechanical micro properties or functions. So that seems like a lovely picture. However, not so fast. This reduction picture is not as neat and clean as it looks. This is because, in general, derivations of thermodynamic properties from the SM theoretic properties and functions require taking the thermodynamic limit, TL. In the thermodynamic limit, various thermodynamic properties, including particle number N and volume V, are assumed to approach infinity. So, for example, in the microcanonical case, the thermodynamic limit consists of allowing the system's particle number, volume, and energy spread all to grow without bound. This is a,
But some ratios have to remain.
Yes, exactly. We'll get to that in a second. Hold on a second. I wanted my little dot back. This is a lovely article, by the way. It actually brought tears to my eyes. It's great. It was that. It was the acknowledgement to the person who inspired the article. The article is good anyway. Okay. So, and for another example, in the canonical ensemble, the expression for the free energy only makes sense, only is useful in the thermodynamic limit. So, for example, in a fluid system specified T, V, and N, statistical mechanics can calculate the free energy, but usually finds that function interesting only in the limit where we take the volume and the particle number to infinity in such a way that the ratio N over V approaches a finite quantity. In the so-called thermodynamic limit, the free energy F itself grows to infinity, but the free energy per particle is expected to approach a finite value. And similarly for certain interesting derived features of thermodynamic properties, so it's natural to assume, and we want to sort of accommodate in our SM theoretic understanding of classical thermodynamics, that thermodynamic properties are extensive, which is to say that they're roughly additive. So, you know, if you have a system with volume V and another with volume V prime, and you combine the systems, the volume should then be V plus V prime. In the microcanonical ensemble, though, a fluid would be specified by E, V, and N. The function of interest is now the entropy, and one expects, for example, that a doubling of E, V, and N will result in a doubling of the entropy. However, this expectation of additivity is not exact for any finite system. And you can see this just by sort of working through some calculations, as Steyer does. The expectation, though, it does hold with increasing accuracy for larger and larger systems, but it's exactly true only in the thermodynamic limit. But where in the world is the thermodynamic limit? Of course, real systems are always finite. If deriving the SM theoretic expressions for thermodynamic properties requires making an assumption that is strictly false, one might wonder whether this undermines the claims to theoretical and hence to explanatory and metaphysical reduction. Now, of course, one thing to say here is that the thermodynamic limit is a useful idealization, reflecting that the macro systems at issue are so large as regards the relevant quantities, in particular as regards the number of particles at issue, that experimental error renders the difference between, say, having a really huge number of particles and having an infinite number of particles negligible. So Steyer asks, why should anyone care about results in the thermodynamic limit when every real system is finite? Well, it's because real bulk systems have so many particles they can be considered to exist in the thermodynamic limit. As the system size increases, the difference between the limit and the finite, the infinite and the finite values will be smaller than experimental error. So from a practical or pragmatic point of view, the assumption of the thermodynamic limit, though strictly false, is perfectly justified. But still, the derivation is unsound. So even so, that the usual SM theoretic derivations appear to depend on this false assumption, it still poses a problem for the usual claims that such macro properties are theoretically reducible to the microphysical goings on. So it strikes me at present that the situation here is interestingly different from some other situations where you have a special science and associated properties which are appropriately seen as approximating more specific microphysical goings on. So in such cases, for example, with Newtonian mechanics and the associated notion of mass, there's reason to think that the microphysical description of the macro phenomena can express the strictly true story. So the strictly true story is given by relativity and so on. Mass is a good approximation, but you know the strictly true story is down at the micro level. But here, by way of contrast, there is reason to think that the microphysical description of the macro phenomena is strictly false, to the extent that that micro description requires appeal to an assumption that is false. But now, if you don't have theoretical reducibility, where are you going to get your metaphysical reducibility? So in turn, a failure of theoretical reducibility undermines the claims of explanatory and metaphysical reducibility. At least, that's something one might say. Actually, I'm going to eventually say that's not so much the case. But there's certainly a natural line of thought here. So what I want to look at in the remainder of the talk is this question. What bearing does the seeming need to appeal to the thermodynamic limit have on the metaphysical status of thermodynamic properties? I'm going to assess certain candidate answers to this question and offer one of my own. So I want to, in particular, I'll start by considering whether a limitivism is appropriate response to the seeming need to appeal to the thermodynamic limit. And then I want to look at two other accounts of the bearing of the thermodynamic limit on the metaphysical status of thermodynamic features, specifically as associated with phase transitions, as involving either emergentism or a renewed reductionism. And here we'll be looking at Batterman's account of phase transitions is, at least on one reading of his work, robustly emergent from the micro phenomena. And then we're going to talk a little bit briefly of Menon and Callender's reasons for thinking that this the failure of the thermodynamic limit to be actualized is no barrier to the explanatory and metaphysical reducibility of phase transitions to SM theoretic goings on. And I'm basically going to just throw that up there, advise that you read Menon and Callender's awesome paper, and then I'm going to basically agree with them that the appeal to the thermodynamic limit doesn't undermine the possibility of there being an explanatory and metaphysical reducibility of thermodynamics to SM. But I'm going to go on and say a question remains about the metaphysical status of what would then be considered SM theoretic phase transitions. And in particular, I'm going to argue that attention to the thermodynamic limit provides two reasons to think that these phase transitions are weakly metaphysically emergent from yet lower level microphysical goings on. And here I'm going to be following in the footsteps of Peter's talk. I think we agree about the idea of weak emergence being appropriately understood as involving some kind of relation between the degrees of freedom. So that was a very helpful. Preface to my talk. Okay, so one thing you could say about the need to appeal to the thermodynamic limit is that, well, I guess those thermodynamic features don't exist. Okay, so if the micro derivation of thermodynamic properties requires a false assumption, then so much for the thermodynamic properties. And here you can compare the Churchland's limitivist stance on the mental. So, you know, their line of thought is roughly as follows. Look, we have really good evidence for the existence of microphysical phenomena. You know, that's our best science tells us that there are such phenomena, so getting rid of them is not an option. Now, what about psychological features? Well, for various reasons, they cannot be located in, cannot be derived from the physics. Well, oh well then, psychological features have to go. Now, eliminativism about the mental is kind of unpopular since it's implausibly at odds with our introspective access to mental states. Now, of course, from an anatomy features don't face that particular difficulty, you know. But on the other hand, it is also omnivism about those such features would also be at odds with the seeming facts. So after all, thermodynamics is a very highly successful science. And in a way, it's even harder to be a eliminativist about thermodynamics because the properties and relations it treats can't be dismissed as a kind of cognitive illusion, as the Churchland suggests are subjective phenomenology is. Plus, and here I'm entering more into the what will be kind of the focus of the remainder of the talk, phase transitions. Plus, phase transitions are ubiquitous. Thermodynamic limit is implicated not just in broadly theoretical thermodynamic features like entropy, but in all kinds of salient macro phenomena. So, you know, iced tea, boiling water, etc., all these are familiar features of daily life. Yet, phase transitions do not exist at all in finite systems. We'll say why. Well, this is why. Because they appear only in the thermodynamic limit. So, indeed, thermodynamic phase transitions are implicated in a wide variety of theoretical and natural domains, ranging from material science and aeronautics to the weather. And I'll mention myself later a little bit more about the transition from ferromagnetic to paramagnetic features of metals, as Laura will be too. And, of course, we've got transitions from non-chaotic to chaotic behavior and dynamic systems. We can't just eliminate all these phenomena. Get rid of most of macro reality, or a lot of it anyway. I'd never be able to wake up in the morning. One way or another, the seeming thermodynamic facts have to be accommodated, but the question is, how are we going to do that if SM can't do the job? Well, this, just by way of setup, too, I want to show or point out that attention to phase transitions provides another perspective on the problem that the thermodynamic limit poses for the usual reductive claims. And this is because such transitions are usually understood to involve a non-analyticity or discontinuity in the function for a thermodynamic quantity. So Menon and Callender say, for example, as pressure is reduced or temperature is raised, liquid water transitions to its gaseous phase. The transitions at such phase boundaries are marked by discontinuity in the density of water. This is an example of a first-order phase transition. Mathematically, phase transitions are represented by non-analyticities or singularities in the thermodynamic potential. And what's a singularity? Well, it's the point at which the potential is not infinitely differentiable. So at a phase transition, some derivative of the thermodynamic potential changes discontinuously. So this is a standard way of thinking about what's going on with phase transitions. You know, we see there's an abrupt transition in the phase of some given substance, and then the mathematics represents that with a non-analyticity or a singularity in the thermodynamic potential. As we'll see later, not all phase transitions involve sort of an observable discontinuity like that. Now, but here's the problem. The statistical mechanical functions that are supposed to be the mirrors or the deeper story of the about the thermodynamic features are all analytic. So, for example, the previous conception makes the phase transition understood, e.g. as a non-analyticity in the free energy F, seem unattainable in statistical mechanics. The reason is that each of the exponential functions is analytic, the partition function is just the sum of exponentials, and the free energy essentially is just a logarithm of this sum. Hence, the energy expressed in terms of the logarithm of the partition function will also be analytic. Okay, so all the functions that enter into providing a theoretical, SM theoretic representation of the thermodynamic features are themselves analytic all down the line. So, hence there will be no phase transitions. The same reasoning can be applied to other thermodynamic functions. But as a matter of fact, the previous line of thought holds only for finite systems. So we can get phase transitions out of the SM theoretic goings on if we introduce the thermodynamic limit. For any finite system, the curve of S is as a function of t might be very steep, but it's never just continuous. But once you take the thermodynamic limit, then we reopen the possibility that these functions might have discontinuities. So Menon and Callender say, look, any finite sum of analytic functions will be analytic. Once this restriction on finitude is removed, however, it is possible to find non-analyticities in the free energy. So, you know, hooray for the thermodynamic limit. It now allows the SM functions to mirror the discontinuities associated with phase transitions in classical thermodynamics. But once again, all real systems are finite. So we're back in the soup about the, you know, problem that the thermodynamic limit seems to make a false assumption. The deeper concern about whether SM can serve as a reductive base for thermodynamic features remains on the table. Okay, so back to the main thread of the dialectic. Don't like eliminativism. Now what are we going to do? One option that has been suggested by some is that the right response is to go strongly emergent. So now, is Bannerman not really a physicalist? I mean, I think there's...
He's changed his mind, right? So now he's a physicalist.
You know, like you said, there's a lot of crosstalk on with respect to these issues. But just for the sake of kind of seeing what certain things somebody... If not Bannerman, think of Schnatterman, okay? So somebody might say the following. Well, look, and some people have talked about emergent behavior. But again, you know, the question is, what do they mean by emergent here? So... Lots of people have said that phase transitions are emergent. Do they mean emergent in my sense, or in some other mine and Peter sense, or in some kind of stronger sense? Well, let's assume that Bannerman means a stronger sense. Here's one way you could motivate that. You could say, if thermodynamic features cannot be soundly derived from microphysical goings-on, then the former cannot be fully explained in terms of the latter, and the former, in that case, must be something metaphysically over and above the latter. So note that the sense of over and aboveness here goes beyond mere non-identity. Rather, what you have is, when we talk about strong emergentism, is something that, if it were to exist, it would falsify physicalism. So the British emergentist take on chemical or mental properties is sort of the paradigm. We have some new fundamental laws that come around once you get certain kinds of complex systems on the scene. You know, the mental field, of course, would be an example of a robustly emergent feature. So Bannerman says that the discontinuity in the thermodynamic potential at a phase transition is not an artifact of the mathematical representation, but it's a genuine feature of physical reality. My contention is that thermodynamics is correct to characterize phase transitions as real physical discontinuities, and it is correct to represent them mathematically as singularities. But then, you know, since SM can't do it, it looks like we have to except that these phase transitions are somehow strongly emergent from microphysical goings-on. Now, there's ways to resist this view, whole bunch of them, actually. But so one thing is to claim that the claim about physical discontinuity is strictly incorrect. So Liu and Callender have independently argued that actual phase-space transitions do not display any discontinuity because there are these fluctuations which render the curve non-singular. And then you accommodate the fact of theoretical irreducibility by granting that phase transitions are conceptually novel, but saying, well, you know, so there's no, you know, the concepts, thermodynamic concepts and statistical mechanical concepts are the latter, or the former are not reducible to the latter, but that doesn't block the, you know, the basic idea of explanatory and metaphysical reducibility. Another thing you could try to do is grant that there's a physical discontinuity, but deny that this phenomenon cannot be captured by finite particles statistical mechanics. So Menon and Callender, for example, argue that one can get singularities in thermodynamic potentials if you work in the microcanonical ensemble. So that would be another way to go. Now, supposing one goes the first route, though, so you want to say, look, it's not really a discontinuity. There's some kind of conceptual novelty, that's true, but really the thermodynamic goings-on can be located in the statistical mechanical goings-on. know, you just basically, here you say, conceptual novelty doesn't have any deep bearing on either explanatory or metaphysical reduction. So this is what I take them to be saying. They say, look, for the case, remember how you have to take the thermodynamic limit in order to get extensivity of various thermodynamic features. Strictly speaking, only in infinite systems are entropy, energy, etc. truly extensive. Does this fact imply that there's a great mystery about extensivity? That extensivity is truly emergent? That thermodynamics doesn't reduce to finite end statistical mechanics? We suggest that on any reasonably uncontentious way of defining these terms, the answer is no. We know exactly what is happening here. Just as the second law of thermodynamics is no longer strict when we go to the micro level, neither is the concept of extensivity. The notion of extensivity is an idealization, but it is one approximated well by finite particle statistical mechanics. So the basic idea here is that given that we have in hand good explanations for why the idealization is required, there simply isn't any good reason to suppose that you have on hand here a robustly emergent phenomenon. And to the extent that strong emergence is supposed to be associated with, you know, serious explanatory gaps, right? Not just failures of representational reduction, but, you know, it's just a mystery how you can get this, given that only this. That's not the situation we have here. So there's a lot more one could say about their criticism of Bowerman's proposal, but I just want to basically grant that they're correct to think that the appeal to the thermodynamic limit doesn't provide any reason to think that thermodynamic macro phenomena are explanatory and metaphysically reducible to SM theoretic micro phenomena. But the deeper moral being here, I take it that theoretical or representational irreducibility does not in itself compel one to accept explanatory or metaphysical irreducibility. Theoretical reducibility is one way to motivate these other forms of reducibility. So if you have a theoretic mapping, that's great. Then you can have an explanatory reduction, and maybe you also can have a metaphysical reduction. But if you don't have one, that doesn't mean that you can't have the other kinds of reduction. There are other ways of motivating the explanatory and metaphysical connections that might be at issue.
Do you mean to say that they
are reducible or not?
I think you meant
that. Yeah, sorry, that should be reducibility.
No, the sense above.
Oh, sorry, up here?
Yeah.
What I produce is basically grant that appeal provides no serious reason to think that are explanatory or metaphysically irreducible.
Or are not.
Right, it doesn't, yeah, it could go either way, exactly. I mean, I think that actually they show satisfactorily that you have explanatory reduction because, you know, we have a very good understanding of what's actually going on here. The question of metaphysical reduction is slightly different. Actually, I'm going to argue that there's a sense in which even if the thermodynamic macro goings on are reducible to, in the sense of being broadly identical with some complicated function of the micro, the statistical mechanical goings on, this one guy, right, now it's one guy, is ontologically irreducible to unconstrained micro entities. So this is going to appeal to something that Peter was talking about as well. So now I want to put my own suggestion on the table. So again, in what follows, I'm just going to grant that these appeals to the thermodynamic limit don't pose any barrier to explanatory and metaphysical reducibility of, in particular, phase transitions. And so I want to now just call these reduced features SM theoretic thermodynamic features, reflecting that for the sake of argument, I'm assuming that we can reduce thermodynamic macro features to statistical mechanical micro features. Okay. Still, I maintain a question remains about the bearing of the thermodynamic limit on such SM theoretic thermodynamic features. And I want to now argue that attention to the thermodynamic limit indicates that some features of thermodynamic systems are not metaphysically reducible to, but are rather weakly emergent from, the features of the micro entities that enter into composing the statistical mechanical aggregates. So just to start, I want to start by setting out this account of weak emergence that I endorse. So first of all, very broadly, two hallmarks of emergent phenomena are dependent on, yet somehow autonomous from, underlying processes, many different notions of dependence and autonomy at issue. The question that motivates people to look into the notion of weak emergence is, as Peter was suggesting, you know, desire to try to make sense of autonomy ontological and other autonomy of macro entities while still remaining broadly physicalist, according to which all broadly scientific entities are, in some sense, nothing over and above the lower level physical entities. So such emergence is sometimes called weak emergence, and the intended contrast is with strong emergence of the sort that would falsify physicalism. Existing accounts of weak emergence combine epistemological autonomy with a reductive account of dependence. So, for example, Vidal, in an influential article, understands the autonomy at issue as being kind of epistemological representational. Okay, so it's weakly emergent phenomena are such that, you know, their explanations are not compressible. We just have to go through the motions to see what happens. But clearly such phenomena as the game of life, etc., are ontologically dependent on and reducible to microphenomena. So this conception of weak emergence understands it as just a merely epistemological notion. But I want to say that, or I want to try to identify a robustly metaphysical conception of weak emergence, and I think we can do so. You can so formulate a conception based on the notion of a degree of freedom. So what are these? Peter said a bit already. They're just states upon which the law governed nomologically possible properties and behavior of an entity functionally depend. So you can call these are the characteristic states. So a DOF is a parameter, more strictly in a minimal set that's needed to describe an entity as being in a characteristic state. Somewhat less roughly, the notion of degree of freedom is as follows. For an entity E, characteristic state S, and a set of coordinates C, the associated DOF are parameters in a minimal set expressed in coordinates C that are needed to characterize E as being an S. And I'll sometimes speak for short of characterizing an entity with the state and coordinates assumed. So it's helpful to look at a couple of examples. The configuration state tracks position. So if you want to specify this state for a free point particle, you need three DOF. Hence, a free point particle has three configuration DOF, and if you have n point particles, then you need three n configuration DOF to characterize the system. And then there's other sorts of states, the kinematic state, which tracks momentum. You need a free point particle has six of those, including a configuration. The dynamic state tracks energies determining the motion. So now, why do we care about degrees of freedom? Note that different entities treated by different sciences may be functionally dependent on the same characteristic state. So for example, in any of the different sciences, the configuration state of the entities that are at issue is going to be a state of interest that you're going to need DOF to characterize. So what I wanted to, what sort of turned me onto degrees of freedom is interesting metaphysically, is that degrees of freedom can track the details of an entity's functional dependence on its characteristic states in a more fine-grained way than the states themselves do. So entities in all the system, you know, have position, right? We all need to have among their DOF, DOF that sort of enable you to say where the system is, but some entities have more range of freedoms within that specification than others. So the values of the DOF and the ranges of values of the DOF are also kind of important, I think. So key to my account is the idea that these fine-grained details concerning functional dependence will serve as a plausible ontological basis for the individuation of broadly scientific entities. So now, Peter talking about reductions in degrees of freedom. I distinguish between reductions, restrictions, and eliminations of degrees of freedom. So the idea being that when you have a reduction, it's important that I read that. So the DOF needed to characterize an entity may be reduced, restricted, or eliminated in certain circumstances compared to those needed to characterize some other entity when such circumstances are not in place. So the idea is that there's going to be certain relations between the DOF that are associated with a composed entity vis-a-vis the system of its composing entities when certain constraints that are characteristic of the composed entity are not in place among the composing entities. So a reduction in degree of freedom will basically give a DOF a fixed value. So you had a point particle freely moving. If you constrain it to the plane, then you get rid of, you give one of its configuration DOF a fixed value, right? So then you only need two DOF to characterize the constrained entity. And more generally, we have rigid bodies in classical mechanics. They, you know, they have their particles kind of have to go along with their friends. You can also have restrictions in DOF where instead of being freely flying around, now you have to stay somewhat near your friends. You have a little bit, like in the molecules, the atoms need to be kind of in the same vicinity, but there's some range of values in the DOF that are associated with their constraints. So molecules restrict the DOF of their composing atoms. And then the sort of relation between DOF that I find most interesting is when the imposition of constraints eliminates degrees of freedom. So sometimes your free point particles might come to compose an entity whose properties and behavior can be characterized using fewer configuration DOF, not because certain of the DOF needed to characterize the unconstrained system are given a fixed value, but because the properties and behavior of the composed entity are just completely functionally independent of those DOF. So a special science case might be spherical conductors treated in electrostatics, where the electric field due to the free particles depends on all charged particles, whereas the electric field due to the spherical conductor depends only on charges of particles on the surface. Okay, I don't have very much time, so I'm just going to basically say, this is my account. Go read my BJBS paper. BJBS 2010. But the idea is that on this account of emergence, the rough idea is that when we have these kind of eliminations in DOF for the case of a composed and a composed entity vis-a-vis the system of its composing entities, when they aren't under the same constraints, you can characterize a notion of weak metaphysical emergence, right, which satisfies the desiderata that it's both compatible with physicalism, right, assuming the lower level entities are physical, and it gets you ontological irreducibility. Now, why is that? I'm not going to have time to talk about the details, but the basic idea is like there's an argument by cases here, okay? Physical acceptability, everybody thinks what we're talking about is physically acceptable, so I won't argue for that. But here, you know, the idea is you've got to say, okay, what would it take for a SM theoretic thermodynamic entity, right, to be identical to a system of unconstrained micro entities, right? Well, the SM theoretic entity would have to be identical to one or the other of these sorts of micro entities. These are the ontologically lightweight resources that the reductionist has, okay? So there's, it could be a relational entity, et cetera, et cetera. But basically what I do is there's an argument by cases where I say, well, the DOF of a composed entity when it's weakly metaphysically emergent will not be identical to any of the reductive candidates, because the reductive candidates all have more DOF. Basically, that's what happens. More DOF, DOF that are not eliminated, right? So by Leibniz's law, if this guy has, you know, n DOF, and this guy has n plus y DOF, or y is not zero, this guy cannot be identical to this guy. So that's the argument by cases. I go through all the different reductive candidates and argue that turns out they're just not, you can't find, located in the unconstrained microphysics, you cannot find any entity that has the same DOF as the statistical mechanical thermodynamic entity. Okay, so they're not identical. Nonetheless, they're physically, obviously these statistical mechanical systems are physically acceptable, So this shows that physical accessibility is compatible with metaphysical irreducibility. Okay. All right, back to thermodynamic systems and the thermodynamic limit. Okay. So what I wanted to suggest is, with this account of weak emergence in hand, I want to suggest there's two routes to seeing SM theoretic thermodynamic systems in the case of phase transitions, in particular as weakly emergent, and having DOF that are eliminated relative to the unconstrained system of their composing entities. So again, here I'm not arguing that thermodynamic macro features are weakly emergent relative to SM theoretic features. I'm granting that they may be identical or reducible. I'm arguing that attention to the thermodynamic limit indicates that the resulting SM theoretic thermodynamic features are themselves weakly emergent from the micro entities that compose SM aggregates. Okay, so route one is application of the RG group. Peter talked about reductions in DOF when we apply the RG group. I think you can say more. I think they eliminate the DOF. So, as Batterman says, in effect, the renormalization group transformation tracking stability of evolution under perturbations of composition, position, velocity eliminates those degrees of freedom, those microscopic details which are inessential or irrelevant for characterizing the system's dominant behavior. Now, what's interesting about the RG method is that, well, it tracks scale invariance, right? But it tracks scale invariance. I'm trying to go, I have to go faster, so hope people are still following me. The RG method will apply also to systems that undergo phase transitions, because phase transitions near their critical points will typically manifest scale invariance. Okay. Now, here's the connection to the thermodynamic limit. Taking the thermodynamic limit is associated with this absence of a characteristic length scale, which is necessary for appropriate application of the renormalization group. So Menon and Callender say, it is significant that the fixed point associated with certain phase transitions only appears when the system has no characteristic length scale. This is why the infinite particle limit is crucial to the renormalization group approach. Thermodynamic limit is crucial. So if the number of particles is finite, then there will be a characteristic length scale set by the size of the system. The requirement for the thermodynamic limit in the renormalization group can be perspicuously connected to the motivation for this limit in the standard SM story. So here again, Menon and Callender are explicit that application of the RG group is indicative of an elimination in micro DOF. This elimination of microscopic degrees of freedom means that renormalization then is blah, blah, blah. But what I want to point out is they just think that microscopic degrees of freedom are eliminated under application of the renormalization group. Okay, so systems that can be modeled by the RG group have eliminated DOF. SM theoretic phase transitions are modeled by the RG group. Therefore, SM theoretic phase transitions have eliminated DOF. And systems with eliminated DOF are weakly emergent. Therefore, SM theoretic phase transitions are weakly emergent. Okay. Since the applicability of the RG group to phase transitions requires the thermodynamic limit, this result constitutes one route to weak emergence in the thermodynamic limit. Now, the second one has to do with not discontinuous phase transitions of the sort that are in the usual case associated with phase transitions that are observable and so on, but rather to continuous phase transitions. So these involve discontinuities. So far we've been just focusing on the first order phase transitions, which involve a discontinuity in the first derivative of the thermodynamic potential. But other thermodynamic phase transitions are continuous, and that transitions occur without any observable discontinuity. Even with these kinds of phase transitions, though, the treatment of such transitions involves a singularity in a higher order derivative. Okay, so there's still discontinuities that enter into the theoretical explanation of continuous phase transitions. So because that's the case, continuous phase transitions also presuppose an appeal to the thermodynamic limit. So an example is moving from ferromagnetism to paramagnetism. As men in calendar say, at room temperature, a piece of iron is permanently magnetized when exposed to an external magnetic field. This configuration remains stable even when the field is removed. Materials with this propensity are called ferromagnetic, but if the temperature is raised above a certain degree, the ferromagnetic properties of iron vanish. Iron is now paramagnetic. It can no longer sustain induced magnetization. So here is the magnetic susceptibility, which is the second derivative of the free energy with respect to magnetization that is discontinuous. Now, such continuous phase transitions, as Menon and Callender point out, are associated with the transition from order to disorder. So they say the transition from order to disorder is also represented as the vanishing of an order parameter. So in the case that we were just discussing, the parameter is the net magnetization of the system. Below the critical point, you have different phases with distinct values of the order parameter. The magnetization vanishes as we approach the critical point and remains zero in the supercritical phase. And I suggest that the vanishing of an order parameter can also be seen as involving an elimination in degrees of freedom, namely in the order degree of freedom. The case here is not as airtight because, you know, when a parameter goes to zero, it may be that the parameter is then getting a fixed value. It's not that the parameter went away entirely, but that the value zero is somehow crucial. Okay. So this requires further exploration on my part to see if this will actually go through. Maybe Laura will have something interesting to say about that. But at least this is a potential case where we have an elimination in degree of freedom that's associated with the thermodynamic limit. All right, so summing up, I've considered how the appeals to the thermodynamic limit in SM theoretic accounts of thermodynamic features might bear on the metaphysical status of such features. I argue that eliminativism is untenable, and emergentism is also implausible. Could be that thermodynamic features are reducible explanatorily and ontologically to statistical mechanical features, but even if that is the case, there's still more to say about the thermodynamics bearing on the metaphysical status of these now potentially reduced features. In particular, there's at least two reasons to think that SM theoretic thermodynamic features are weakly metaphysically emergent from the comparatively unconstrained systems of microentities that compose SM aggregates and having DOF that are effectively eliminated in the thermodynamic limit. So that's it.